KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Richmond in East Bay.
Tara Hill Spinall.
Dolores at Market Street.
Daly City.
Outer Sunset.
Castro and Church.
Coming up, birds that have been nesting in downtown Oakland for years have lost their homes, but they might be getting new ones at Lake Merritt.
The question was, how can we do right for people and right for birds all in one fell swoop?
The Great Heron Experiment. Then, trying to disrupt stereotypes about who is and who is not outdoorsy.
People tell me all the time, well, Black people don't have a relationship with wild spaces.
And we'll hear the memories of the oldest park ranger in the country, stationed right here in the Bay Area.
I was the only one in the room who could look at the scattered sites and see them all as sites of segregation.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. If you've been to downtown Oakland in the last few years, you may have noticed birds nesting in the trees. If you haven't noticed the birds, maybe you've noticed the poop. Downtown Oakland has been home to a large nesting colony of herons, a kind of water bird, but their nesting site is being developed. So biologists are trying to lure the birds to Lake Merritt instead. KALW's Marissa Ortega-Welch has more about this great heron experiment.
It's a sunny day at Lake Merritt, and biologist Steven Peterson is up in a tree testing a speaker. It's playing a recording of herons.
Yeah, so that would be the adults screeching, and then the kick, 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 kick. Those are the chicks. Those would be the chicks. So if you've ever been over by the rookery over there in downtown Oakland, this is what it sounds like.
In fact, he's trying to lure the birds who've nested in downtown Oakland for years to come nest at this spot at Lake Merritt instead. A little down the lakeshore, I watch an arborist lifted up to the tree canopy in a cherry picker. Another arborist climbs up into the branches of a different tree. Biologist Kevin Cahill is down below, surrounded by a pile of boxes filled with bird nests.
Tying a rope onto this box here.
To send up to the guys in the tree, who take out the sticks, the very sticks herons used last year to build their nest downtown.
And basically build a new nest for these guys and gals.
Developers got permission to remove the nests to make way for two new apartment buildings. In exchange, they hired this team of biologists to try and relocate the bird rookery to Lake Merritt.
One sec!
Hence the bird recordings, the nest relocation, and fake birds.
They made it nice and tight for me. See, it's got kind of some, like a metal post for the legs. The legs are painted pink.
A black-crowned night heron. It's a foot-tall, gray-blue bird with a long neck and long legs for wading in the water. These are decoys. Herons are social. They want to nest with other herons. So if the real birds see these decoys in the tree, the hope is that they'll come join them to nest.
If I was a heron, I'd probably want to come over and check it out, you know, if I was flying by. What about you? What do you think?
I'm impressed. Yeah, I think it looks really good.
I've been waiting for this moment for a long time. I used to work at Golden Gate Audubon Society, a local bird conservation organization, which pushed the city to require the developers to attempt this relocation project when we learned that the trees were going to get cut down. For years now, two species of birds, black-crowned night herons and snowy egrets, have taken to nesting in downtown Oakland. These herons are sort of like the raccoons of the bird world. They don't seem to mind living around people, and they especially like the large ficus trees all over downtown, like the ones in the parking lot by the post office.
There were these nests filling up all these street trees on the block.
That's Cindy Margulis, executive director of Golden Gate Audubon Society and my former boss.
It was noisy, and there was a lot of poop.
It was wild. Nature right in the city, the largest black-crowned night heron rookery in the Bay Area. But things came to a head a few years ago.
So in 2014, the U.S. Post Office branch downtown Oakland, they ordered a tree cut at the wrong time of the year when the herons were nesting because they didn't want the herons pooping on their postal trucks.
Four young birds had to be taken to rehab. It was a wake-up call for the Audubon staff. Some people found these herons to be a nuisance. Wilderness in the city is not always pretty.
So the young birds can fall out of the trees. They can also push out their siblings sometimes.
It's part of nature. But what's not part of nature? Concrete and cars. In a more natural environment, soft duff or mud cushions baby birds' falls, and bushes act like stepladders for birds to get back into nests.
So it was pretty gruesome. You would see birds dying or already dead laying on the street.
Golden Gate Audubon knew it had to get involved. It was my job to train volunteers to monitor the nests. The docents came out almost every day to walk the streets of downtown Oakland and look for baby birds that had fallen out of trees and were hiding at the bus stop, under parked cars.
I'm sure our docents looked ridiculous with their heads underneath wheel wells in the parking lot.
Then they'd call the Oakland Zoo to come out and rescue the birds. The birds did not go quietly.
The bird's gonna scream, and it actually has a scream that's very much like a dinosaur, and it looks a little bit like a dinosaur too.
Zookeepers transferred the birds to the International Bird Rescue Center, where the birds stayed until they were able to fly. Then they were released out into marshes around the bay. Much better habitat. This went on for 2 years. Then Audubon staff learned the main heron nesting spots were slated for development. The trees that the post office once trimmed were now going to get cut down. Audubon's Cindy Margulis felt torn.
I was struggling with how do we protect these birds? But obviously that is not the best place for them to be because we knew we were having to rescue so many of those birds.
And she didn't want to stand in the way of development.
Housing is a shortage for people in downtown Oakland. So we totally understand that those developments are needed. So the question was, how can we do right for people and right for birds all in one fell swoop?
Margulis pushed the city of Oakland to require the developers to try and relocate the nesting herons. And to her surprise, they agreed. I have to say, I've wondered whether this was all worth it. Heron populations are doing fine in the Bay Area, at least right now. What if we spend all this time and money and it doesn't work?
It is a science experiment. There's no doubt about that. But it's based on good science. And in this case, the financial burden is actually being borne by the developers.
The developers hired an environmental consulting group, H.T. Harvey & Associates, to do the relocation. After herons finished nesting last year, the biologists collected the nests from the old trees, boxed them up, and stored them over the winter. Those trees got cut down, and now the nests are being installed in trees around Lake Merritt.
So hopefully, they will have gotten a good winter season, come back, discover these new rookery sites, and go, oh, this is great. Now I've got the premier lakefront real estate. I'm definitely moving in here.
Ray Connell is the development manager for the building going up on 14th Street. When his company, Holland Partner Group, bought the property, he immediately Googled the herons. The first thing he read was about the incident with the post office.
That was a red flag. I figured we could not do whatever we did, we could not do that.
He drove around the site, but it was winter before nesting season, and he didn't see any of the birds.
Fast forward about 6 weeks later, I saw the influx of all the herons coming to roost.
Connell says the relocation is costing his company and the other developer more than $200,000. And I just wonder, why would you buy a building that came with so many strings or birds attached?
As a developer, you would say, because we get to build apartments and that's great for us. But it's actually a really great thing for the city and for the birds because now they're in a place where hopefully they'll go to a place where they can actually thrive. And we won't have, 70 plus birds, baby birds falling out of trees and getting hit by cars and falling on top of the post office vehicles.
Connell takes me on a walk around the development lot.
It's going to be 262 apartment units. It's going to be 7 stories.
The trees on his property are gone, but herons still live in the trees across the street.
Yeah, you can see them up in there. See 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Kind of looking down at us, looking, trying to see what we're doing.
What happens if all the herons who lost their nests just spread out to other trees around downtown? How will Connell feel after his company has put in all this work and all this money?
Yeah, we really do want it to work, and Yeah, I think down at the lake will be a much better place for them. Yeah, it'll be a little disheartening. But hopefully, you know, over time, they'll move back to the lake. That's the goal.
A few weeks after the nests went up, I returned to Lake Merritt. Biologist Miriam Eckhart is looking through her binoculars.
So I'm surveying the islands by the Rotary Center. For any nesting activity, I think I see an adult night heron roosting in a tree.
The herons are at the lake, but it's too soon to say whether they're taking to the relocated nests. We do know that the Audubon staff and building developers will be rooting for the birds. For Cross Currents, I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch in Oakland.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. One of the Bay Area's main attractions is its proximity to nature. Only 45 minutes separate Bay Area residents from arriving at the ocean, the mountains, or a hiking trail. But not everybody experiences the Bay Area's natural beauty. Last year, New America Media commissioned a nationwide survey of 900 African American, Asian, and Hispanic voters. It asked them how often they visit our national public lands. Turns out, nearly half had never been to a national park. Back in 2014, KLW reporter Todd Whitney decided to take a closer look at the perception that Black folks aren't really into nature.
Dad, there's a mountain of statistics that say Black Americans don't go out in nature as much as other ethnicities. I mean, it's something that I can believe, because I kind of live it and I fit into the statistic. I'm Black and I kind of like nature, but I don't really mess with it in a traditional sense. And I know I'm not alone in that. I'm here in Joaquin Miller Park in Oakland, California with Rue Mapp, the founder and CEO of Outdoor Afro.
Outdoor Afro is an online and in-person social and nature network. And it's our goal to celebrate and inspire African-American connections to nature.
I took a hike with Rue and other hikers on a Sunday morning, and I asked them about what they think of Black folks and nature not mingling much.
I think a lot of times, a lot of Black people, like for me, we're originally from Chicago and we lived in a very concentrated area, cement city really. So in the city, we just knew city life and city stuff, but we didn't know like outdoorsy stuff. But once you move away from the environment, then you can do outdoorsy stuff.
That's Kush Anderson. She and her son Jermaine traveled from Sacramento to participate in today's hike. Then there was Krishna Jude Moore. So I asked Jude Moore if he was familiar with any Black American contributions to the environmental movement.
It was a Black man who came up with peanut butter, and everybody I know who goes camping, I mean, you got to have peanut butter.
Moore's talking about George Washington Carver, and he's not just the inventor of peanut butter, but he's one of the most prominent agriculturalists and inventors of the 1800s. These contributions that we tend to forget about are what Rue Mapp thinks is part of a rich history of outdoor exploration and environmentalism that Black Americans have been part of. Our group leader, Rue Mapp, breaks it down for us.
So much of our history there, and so that one of the things that Outdoor Afro aims to do is to break open not only the natural history of a place, but the human history of a place. And in that way, we're able to help people feel a deeper sense of connection, purpose, as well as a sense of ownership. Like, this is mine. You know, these are where my people dwelt.
History's a big part of these walks for Rue Mapp. She told me about the Buffalo Soldiers. The Buffalo Soldiers, they were an all-Black military unit that later became some of America's first park rangers. But the Black tradition of outdoor contributions goes beyond the Buffalo Soldiers. There's also individuals like John Francis. He's a Black man who grew up in Marin County, and he walked across America to promote environmentalism back in the 70s. To learn more about some of these Black environmentalists, I met up with Carolyn Finney. She's the author of Black Faces, White Spaces, and she's a professor of environmental policy and management at UC Berkeley.
In terms of the majority culture, historically in the United States, setting a narrative and a tone about the environment and the way we should think about it and relate to it, we Black and brown folks have largely been left out of that mainstream conversation.
So Finney says being left out takes a couple different forms. One of those is representation in environmental and government organizations, where people of color represent somewhere between 12% and 16%, while we make up nearly 40% of the U.S. population. Then there's the media's representation of Black folks in nature. Dr. Finney looked into this. She picked up a decade's worth of issues of Outside Magazine. That's one of the most popular outdoor enthusiast magazines around. In it, of the 4,600 photos that had people in them, just over 100 featured Black Americans. And those are mostly famous male athletes. Doing my own little experiment, I checked out the latest edition of Outside Magazine.
Nah. Hey, there's a familiar face. There's a brother right there. There's one. Nah.
In the latest edition of Outside, out of the 87 photos that have people in them, only 8 feature Black Americans. But representation isn't just about jobs and the images in magazines. It's about the larger narrative we create about the environment and the outdoors. Black people do get outside, just not in the traditional ways that we tend to think about the outdoors. Some people get their outdoor activities by hitting a hiking trail, while others might just kick it over to Lake Merritt for a barbecue. It all doesn't have to look the same. Again, here's Rue Mapp from Outdoor Afro.
People tell me all the time, well, Black people don't have a relationship with wild spaces. But when I start talking about fishing, for instance, ears perk up and the stories unfold.
Some of those stories are part of a history when coming together in public spaces wasn't always safe for Black folks. And that legacy of not having safety in numbers has led to a particular way of thinking about nature. When the Outdoor Foundation surveyed Americans and asked why they don't take advantage of nature, more than a third of Black Americans said they're just not interested.
Nature has a PR problem. For generations, people have worked really hard on farms. The idea of going out and sleeping on the ground is not appealing. It doesn't signal progress to some people. I've actually have heard some people say, why are you going to play homeless?
Well, in my experience on the hike, with the birds, the smells, the views, the tranquility, it felt really good to be outdoors. I might even start to switch my walks around Lake Merritt in Oakland for more hikes in the hills. In Oakland, I'm Todd Whitney for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. If you've ever visited the museum at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historical Park on the Richmond waterfront, chances are you've heard of its most celebrated storyteller. At age 96, Betty Reed Soskin is the country's oldest park ranger. Her talks pack the house, and she's helped to shape the scope of the museum through her personal recollections. Now, Betty Reed has written a book about her experiences called Sign My Name to Freedom, a memoir of a pioneering life. And at one point in that life, she sat down with StoryCorps to tell her story.
Rosie the Riveter as a concept leaves out an awful lot of history. As a woman of color, during that period, I never did see a ship under construction. I came in to work every day in a carpool, working in the center of Richmond in a temporary building that was the segregated union hall, because the unions were not yet racially integrated. So all of the black workers were funneled into this temporary union, where we had no power, no vote, paid union dues, but were segregated. But you have to go back 3 years before then. I would have been Betty Charbonnet graduating from high school in Oakland. I would have been the child of a service workers' generation. Our fathers and our uncles were the Pullman porters and the waiters and the red caps, the bellhops, the janitors. Our mothers were 50 cents an hour domestic servants who took care of white people's homes and white people's children. And when I graduated from high school, my full expectation was to take my place in that world. And if you now scroll ahead to 13 years ago, and I'm back in Richmond as an equal participant in the planning of a park, I was the only one in the room who could look at the scattered sites and see them all as sites of segregation, because I'm the only person of color in the room. I became of value as a primary source. And I'm doing that, not having become a genius between the time I was 20 and 13 years ago, but as a result of how much social change had occurred in this nation over those intervening years. And much of that acceleration came about because of what happened here in Richmond. Henry Kaiser, who believed that he could revolutionize shipbuilding, that all he had to do was to de-skill labor and break it into bite-sized pieces that even women could do or even black people could do. And he brought into a city of 23,000 a workforce of 98,000 black and white Southerners into Richmond to build his ships without the benefit of focus groups and diversity training, and that they had to negotiate every day to get through it, and that negotiation could happen, accelerated the rate of change that sowed the seeds of the Civil Rights Revolution in the 60s. What I haven't said is that my great-grandmother was born into slavery in 1846, that she was enslaved until she was 19. She was freed with the Emancipation Proclamation. But my great-grandmother lived to be 102. My mother, who was born in 1894, lived to be 101. But the three of us were all adult women together. And that all of that American history, slavery through Reconstruction and Plessy v. Ferguson and the First World War and Lindbergh's flight.
Lindbergh is coming down the gangplank.
Amelia Earhart.
Then to a waiting world came news of disaster.
And Martin Luther King and Malcolm X.
That one day on the red hills of Georgia.
Selma and Birmingham.
We are going to walk non-violently and peacefully.
And the moon landing and the Mars probe.
KL flight controller is gonna go for landing. Retro.
Go.
Rhino.
Go.
Guidance.
Go.
Control.
Go.
Telcom.
Go.
GNC.
Go.
Ecom.
Go.
Surgeon.
Go.
Capcom, we're go for landing.
The assassination of the Kennedys.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
All of that happened within the lifetime of three American women of color. That's not black history. That is what we've all done.
That's Betty Reed Soskin. She told her story to StoryCorps. That piece was produced by Lizak Shalit and engineered by Colin Peden. You can find a link to her new book called Sign My Name to Freedom at klw.org. Click Crosscurrents. And that's the show for today. Our Cross Currents team includes Atemu Atan, Angela Johnston, Nina Gensler-Debs, Amber Miles, Lisa Morehouse, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rollins, Gabe Graben, and Jackie Sajiko. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley-Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet.
Since 1943. I got those back home blues. That's the kind that worried me.
To Today's local music is by the Stan Earhart Band. They're performing tomorrow night at John Foley's Irish House in San Francisco. Show starts at 10 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Serve me right to suffer, serve me right to be alone. Oh, just living with the memories, the days is passing gone. Every time I see a woman, you know it makes me think about mine. Every time I see a woman, you know it makes me think about mine.